Welcome to Anthony Plogon Music. This is Eddie Ludema, producer of the show. In the bonus room, Aaron, Jason, and Tony talk about the differences between stress and distress and how to relieve distress in a performance situation, including an idea that Jason calls flipping the script. But first, before we get into the conversation, we'd like to share with you a brief message from our friends at Dorico, the cutting-edge music notation and engraving system from Steinberg.
Create music that moves with Dorico 5, the brand new version of the music notation and composition software from Steinberg. Packed with new features throughout the application, it's the perfect time to update from your current version or to try Dorico for the first time. You can start for free with Dorico SE or Dorico for iPad, which now allow projects with up to 8 players. Or step up to Dorico Elements, which now allows projects of unlimited size and features an expanded engrave mode. For professional use, choose Dorico Pro, which has many unique features you won't find in any other software. Visit www.steinberg.net/Dorico today and make more time for music.
I'd like to talk a little bit about stress, and I have a question for you about a book by Jim Lohr. I don't know if you've heard of this. He's a sports, I don't know if you'd say psychologist or not, but he works with a lot of sports people. And in this one book called The Power of Full Engagement, he talks about stress, and he says stress is not bad if it's balanced with relaxation. And he has four areas where he talks about this, where people, some of the times there's too much relaxation or recovery, and in other areas, there's too much stress. And for example, for most, he's talking about business mainly. So with a lot of businessmen, there's way too much relaxation in terms of physically taking care of your body, that you need to stress the body more. And his idea is, like, for example, using weightlifting as a metaphor, that you, if you break your arm and it's in a cast for 2 months, let's say, there's no stress at all. And when you get out of the cast, it's withered, it's very weak. So you need stress to build that up, but you need a day. You'll have maybe one day of working out with weights, one day relaxation, one day stress, one day relaxation. And I wonder if that's something you approach also from the work you're doing, or do you agree with that concept?
Typically, when people use the word stress, what they mean is distress. So they automatically have a negative label. But there's also eustress.
Then what's the difference between distress? I understand that. And stress. How is stress different from distress?
If you're responding to something, it's what you associate. You know, if the body is ramping up to engage in a fight-flight stage, then you might have an association of, you might have good associations with that or not so much. Let's say you love sport and you're going out and you're engaging. If I ran out into the street and ran up and down, you know, my heart rate would go up, my blood pressure would go up. But when we're standing backstage, we feel exactly the same thing. But suddenly the psychological makeup and the envelope around that is entirely different. So one of the things that we tend to talk about in a performance psychology framework is to say, well, look, you know, performing is different from practicing. That makes a difference to the audience. And as we see in other studies, audiences like live performances. They don't want to hear your practice session. They want to hear your performances. But, you know, if you're feeling these sensations, then take that as a signal that you're ready to perform. This means that I'm ready to go, rather than a signal that, oh my, something's going to go wrong. So I think the difference here is when you start talking about stress and anxiety and bleeding the two into one another. So anxiety is an issue of worry around the psychological state, around a particular moment. And, you know, it tends to be associated with different sorts of feelings that you may have. So, you know, you can look to moderate, manage levels of anxiety. But if you're feeling that buzz before performance or the excitement, then think of it as excitement and a buzz and not necessarily straight leading into anxiety. So there's just a mental framework around that. And of course, you know, we see very old relationships from 1908, the Yerkes-Dodson inverted U, that, you know, if you're too laid back and too relaxed, you're not going to perform at your best. Likewise, if you're too jittery and too uptight, you're not going to perform at your best. So we need some sort of midpoint of engagement, of of stress in order to perform at your best. Now, the problem is that my midpoint may be different from your midpoint, and trying to tap that in, and it may be influenced as well by the sort of task that you're doing, how difficult it is, who you're doing it in front of. So there are all these psychological factors that come, that get piled on top of this with all the years of experience that we all have in doing it, that tends to create the problems rather than just the sheer excitement of performance.
Using Jason as an example, so Jason, suppose like you're sitting on stage and you have you're playing Petrushka and the ballerina's dance is coming up, or you're playing Zarathustra and the trumpet call is coming up. So you're sitting there, and I think if you're normal, probably there's some tension that's building up. Let's suppose like there's another Jason, and you're now a ballet dancer, and you have a difficult leap to do. But before that leap, you're running around the stage doing whatever you do in this ballet. And it seems to me, and Aaron, maybe you can address this, that sitting still, having to sit still before a difficult passage is much more difficult than, or even if you're playing jazz where you can move your body a lot, than a lot of movement, that seems to be a way that you can dissipate distress, as opposed to sitting in an orchestra where you can't have that possibility.
I'll jump with the fight flight response. What you're doing is that you're activating big muscle groups, because you're either going to run or you're going to fight. And so from an evolutionary point of view, that's an incredibly helpful thing to have. What that means is that activating big muscle groups means that, you know, the fine motor skills that you may need to call on in order to execute your performance, that's directly competing with the big, the notion of activating big muscle groups. You've got blood flow that's changed in the body because it's moving away from the core. You get a sense of butterflies. We're putting our very old selves into quite new social constraints that mean that the psychosocial stress that we experience makes us think more and differently and so on. So absolutely. I mean, if you're not able then to get some of that energy out, I mean, there's evidence to suggest that even a single session of exercise before a stressful event, cardiovascular type exercise, can help to suppress the release of stress hormones within a certain time period after that. Getting the body into shape and knowing, you know, how your body responds to stress is an important thing to try to work out.
That's definitely something that I do and colleagues do as well. That exercise definitely does seem to dissipate some of the stuff that goes on during a concert. I think I think you're absolutely right in the way that having to sit still and be kind of stuck almost within these very strict rules that you're given, and it means that you can't actually be free with yourself and kind of allow these feelings to wash over you. You can, and then respond to them in your own way. You're definitely right. But I think that, I mean, there are ways to acknowledge those feelings while sitting still. But, and I think it's very important that we acknowledge those feelings rather than just try to ignore them. Because that we all know, the more that we try to ignore something, the more it's just going to be there. And, you know, the elephant in the room, it really will become the elephant in the room. Personally, I just try to immerse myself in the music ever since that one of my teachers said to me, how did the gig go? And they were like, I don't care how you played, how was the gig? That actually, that's something that was like a real turning point for me, because I suddenly become less focused on playing the trumpet and more focused on creating music. And actually, it's one of the things like that I really don't enjoy about being a soloist, actually, standing out front. You know, it's the pressure's kind of all on you, and it's on you to do all this. And to be honest, I actually just miss being part of something bigger. And I really like being a cog in a much bigger machine, where the end goal is music, which it's not playing our instruments.
Yeah, I think that's great. And of course, the orchestral repertoire is phenomenal. I mean, we're playing the music of the great giants. So that's a pretty good way to make a living. Let me ask you a quick question about practicing. And actually, Aaron, you can weigh in on this too. The thing that's been so interesting for me about this podcast has been the diversity of answers about certain things and, you know, about phrasing things that I thought, you know, oh, everybody agrees with this. And a lot of times people will have a totally different idea about it. And one thing that was very interesting to me was I had an interview with Chris Martin and Joe Alessi, and then also with Håkon Hardenberger. And Chris Martin said, I always perform when I practice. And Håkon said, I never perform when I practice. Practice is for practicing. And then when I go out on stage, I just let it go. Where are you on that?
I think there's balance to be found within those. I do like the idea of performing all the time. I think that's, I mean, obviously it's a good practice tool, but at the same time that can be exhausting. I mean, in terms of rehearsing with the orchestra, if you're performing every single note, if you're performing every single time, that's exhausting, you know, and it really both physically, but to be honest, more mentally. But I do, the kind of the flip side of that is that I do really like the idea of a musical solution to a technical problem. You know, so if you've been finding a technical issue that you really are really struggling with, and it's something that you're struggling to overcome by just purely thinking about how you're going, the mechanics of doing it. Actually, if you approach it from a musical standpoint and you allow the physical side to just be kind of almost, you know, you allow yourself, your brain and your the practice that you've done for such a long time to just take over, and then you can actually approach it from a completely different angle, all of a sudden everything seems to make sense again. And I think it's one of those things about performing where when we get into that fight, flight, or freeze kind of state, you know, particularly as a brass player, if we get into that freeze state and everything starts to lock up, and, you know, with your breathing and physically everything gets really tight, it's very difficult to even make a sound. And then all of a sudden we start thinking about the minute details of like, oh, okay, why is my tongue there? Is my throat, is my chops are doing this? And actually none of that matters. All of that stuff is second nature. You know, because we've been doing it for so long, we've forgotten how to do all of those fundamental things. So when we start rethinking them, we can't do it. And so actually we wind ourselves into more and more problems. So I think if allowing ourselves just to do all the stuff that we do naturally so well and approach things from a musical standpoint, I think can often be very, very helpful. But, you know, I do think there is a sense of balance between the two. You know, if I'm doing my like boring lip bends and that sort of stuff, I wouldn't say that I'd be performing those every day. I'd definitely be lying if I said I was.
Yeah. When I was quite young, I had a lesson with Adolf Herseth, and this backs up what you're saying. I asked him, I said, what do you do if you have a really difficult solo to play and you have bad chops? And he said, instead of saying, like you said, what should I do with my tongue or chops or whatever? He just thought, he said, I think, how would that solo sound if it was played really beautifully as it could be played? And he said he felt like he actually played a lot of his best concerts with bad chops because he had to concentrate on that so much. And that sounds exactly like what you're saying.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
And I don't think he was interested in scientific research at all, but he just had it, you know, he just had that mental strength.
Yeah.
Well, for me, the big question, there's a lot of data in your research. By the way, in England, you say data or data?
I would say data.
Data, okay. Okay.
But I'm American originally, so...
I'd say data. Data. Okay. Yeah, I'd say data as well, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You're from American. I didn't realize that. Where are you from?
Yeah, I'm from South Carolina.
Oh, okay. Wow, I don't hear
I've been in the UK since 96, though, so...
Okay. Well, anyway, with all this data that you come up with, do you have recommendations for students who are going to take an audition, or even professionals who are going to take an audition and are worried about being nervous? I mean, are there exercises that students can do, specific strategies that they can incorporate into not only their practice, but when they actually walk on stage, thinking about their breathing or visualization? Or have you gotten into that area very much yet?
Well, I think more generally speaking, not on a specific instance basis, but more generally in terms of approaching things like performance anxiety, it's worth trying to take stock of what the symptoms are that tend to bother you the most. What are the symptoms causing trouble? If they tend to be largely physical, So, you know, the issue is that your body is racing and you don't know how to deal with it. Then you can pick a sort of physical type intervention to combat that. So there's evidence to suggest that people who are more physically fit, they do more regular, they're chronic exercisers. By that, I don't mean lifting weights, I mean cardiovascular type exercise. Because their body is becoming more efficient at dealing with the physical stress of exercise, it crosses over and can have a transfer effect into helping their bodies deal with the psychosocial stressor that's around performance. However, the physical symptoms are one type. Behavioral symptoms are another type. So these are the sorts of things where you telegraph your nervousness to everybody else. And so, but you're often not very aware that you're doing it. So it might be pacing back and forth, or the way that you hold yourself and sway back while you're on stage, avoiding social contact with other people backstage, or anything like that. Then it's because they're unconscious, you can try to work very deliberately to at least take stock of what these things are and then make a change. So having access to videos of your performances and so on can help there. And then for the psychological symptoms, where it's a pattern of negative thinking or catastrophizing, then, you know, there may be issues where you look to the sort of work of a sports psychologist with mental skills training, cognitive behavioral therapy, or other types of interventions like that can help give you some sort of grasp on this. It's important to, you know, think about the enjoyment that you get from performing. I mean, having that sort of purpose and sense of accomplishment and the way of what you're bringing to an audience, and not necessarily assuming that the audience is there to be overly critical or to be out to get you. So just a way of thinking about the whole experience and turning that into a positive approach can be very helpful too. And developing good positive habits can help.
So, for example, if I was, let's say, a graduate student auditioning for an orchestra, and normally calm and in incredibly great physical shape, cardiovascular shape, a lot of swimming, running, stuff like that, and I'm going to take an audition, and 5 minutes before I go on stage, I think, wow, I'm really nervous. This is unusual for me. What can I do?
Well, I mean, thinking that, well, I'm nervous, maybe thinking about what an opportunity this is. I think it would take a little bit more detailed study just to come up with a great plan of action there. But, you know, with mental skills training, you don't just say, oh, I'll try this thing out that I've never tried before and it's going to work for me well. You have to practice your mental practice. And so it's really about having access to that. But we know from sports that, you know, mental practice can help in a number of elements in terms of trying to get you to think differently about your artistry, and trying to even progressing your own physical practice can be aided by mental practicing. So, you know, there may not be direct, easy solutions, but I think it's important to start integrating mental practicing and this sort of activity with your physical practicing on a regular basis. So there are books around this, and you can read more about mental skills training from a range of different texts, even looking at specific exercises. So I did a book called Musical Excellence, and chapter 12 of that book is called Mental Skills Training, which I wrote with a sports psychologist called Christopher Connolly. And there are some exercises in that chapter that you can read through that give you different solutions to different types of problems, or even different ways to enhance what you're trying to enhance.
There was a book that came out many, many years ago, a sports book called Peak Performance by Charles Garfield. And he told of a study where they had like really elite track and field people, and they divided them up. You know, let's say they were all doing the same sport, whatever it was, and they divided them into three groups. And one group did mental visualization for 15 minutes and physical training for 45 minutes. The second was 50-50. And then the third was 45 minutes of visualization and 15 minutes of actual physical training. And that was the group that scored the highest, that did the best. And I thought, geez, that means if I'm practicing that I spend 45 minutes out of every hour just visualizing, that seems extremely extreme.
But when it comes to visualization and that sort of mental practicing, there are different ways to visualize. And so, you know, if you are just starting out on a piece and the way that you want to practice visualizing is that you imagine being within your own body, physically playing the piece, that's completely the wrong strategy at that point. The reason is because you don't know the piece well enough. You're probably going to be rehearsing in things that you're going to have to unlearn later because you don't know it that well. So at the beginning of learning a piece, what you might want to do is to zoom out of your body, imagine you or your teacher or some other performer playing the piece, focusing on things that aren't physical, that are more around sound, trying to get a conceptions, developing, you know, aspects of your interpretation. And then later on, when having, you know, the piece under your fingers and ready to go, then you can then come back in your body and try to do mental practicing where you're mentally working through the physical effort of actually giving that performance. And so that gives you a chance to, you know, all that extra practice time. What that does is that, you know, you're sending signals through your body at slightly below threshold level. So you're reinforcing the motor program, but you're not tiring out the muscles as well. So it's important to know some of the nuance around this, of course. Another element around visualization is that some people just aren't highly visual. They're more driven by sound or maybe kinesthetic elements of how their body moves. And you know, to make a visualization session incredibly powerful, it's good to try to bring all the senses in on this. So when you've got elite downhill skiers working to work their way through a course, they're able to do a mental run through of a course that they know well, and they're incredibly precise in terms of how they go through that course. And when they finish that mental run through, their timings are pretty similar to what they would get if they're actually going down the course. So there's a great deal of practicing involved in doing all of that. So when that sort of embodied mental rehearsal, I think, really needs to be done for the sort of polishing and finessing stages of learning a piece and other types of mental rehearsal, where you think more musically, more artistically, should be done in the earlier stages. And of course, you can work that in the later stages too. I'll say one other thing too, is that in terms of mental rehearsal, I mean, one of the things that we tend to do is to start with a relaxation technique. So why would you do that? Well, it's because, you know, we always have things flitting through the mind, and then doing a relaxation technique, something like progressive relaxation, where you control your breath and you work tension out of segmented parts of the body so that you can isolate, say, your forearm, and you think of getting the tension out of the forearm. I mean, doing that to start before going into visualization helps just to establish greater connections between what you're thinking and how you're feeling and getting things going. It's not to say that you want to go into a performance being completely relaxed. I mean, so the relaxation exercises are good for relaxing the body, but also if you need to be, but they're also good at the beginning of a mental practicing session because you can get clearer signals between what you're thinking and what you need to rehearse. And you don't have a lot of contamination with distracted thoughts and other things coming in.
Jason, any final thoughts you might have?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, I mean, the big one that would kind of really, really help me was flipping the script, really. Going into auditions or performance situations, There's a lot of, you know, fear of failure, fear of looking like an idiot, fear of what your colleagues are going to think, fear of what your friends are going to judge you, that sort of stuff. And I remember almost as kind of as my mantra, it was kind of like, oh, this could go so badly or it could go so well. And it's trying to, again, you know, we were talking about the words distress and stress and how there are, you know, negative connotations with certain words, and actually thinking about how we can, you know, flip everything on its head, and actually, rather than thinking of how badly this could go, thinking about how well this could go, how much I'm not enjoying this moment, but thinking actually how much I could enjoy this, because I do, there's a reason that I pick up the trumpet every day and keep doing it, that there must be a reason why I'm still trying to do this. and you know, and trying to really tap into those positive energies rather than getting wound up and caught up in the negativity that is only just going to cause you to become trapped in your own thought patterns. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot to kind of unpack with fear. Like there's obviously a lot to think about and a lot that you can do. But you know, because oftentimes I do have students who come and see me before they have an audition, so we can talk through their excerpts and we can maybe talk a bit through their piece. But I kind of have two bits of advice that I give them. The first one is don't get caught up on the excerpts. It's actually learn the music. Don't learn the notes on the page. So instead of learning the 8 bars that they've given you, go and learn the whole piece. You know, if you get given the opening a mile of 5, I don't think it's enough to just know how the first 12 bars go, but you need some kind of perspective on that, on the opening of the piece. And then the other one for me really is just simplify the process, whatever that process is. You know, if you can make performing as simple and as enjoyable as possible, then you will reach your goal efficiently, which is enjoyment. And you know, as a brass player, 9 times out of 10 that comes down to breathing. For, you know, I've personally found that breathing is the thing that really affects how I perform, and you know, how I approach that and how I think about it are the things that really help me.
Yeah, I think that's probably true for most bass players, at least. Maybe all wind players as well.
Well, I recently had to start conducting a little bit at the college, which has been an experience all in itself. But breathing again is still such a key part of doing that.
Well, this is an area where I think we're. Aaron, would you say that in this area of psychology and music, if you would call it that, that we're pretty much in the beginning stages of this?
Yeah, there's a lot more there's a lot more research that we need to do. But what I find really an exciting possibility is doing this research in a conservatoire or school of music context where, you know, so many colleagues have really empirically tractable questions that we can start to dig into, and you know, staying open to the possibility of advancing and innovation and so on. I think it's all very exciting.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Like, I do think it's a very exciting time, and you know, the parallels that can be drawn from sports and elsewhere. I think it's I don't think we're starting at the very beginning, but I think obviously there's a lot to unpack.